You need to get there fairly early in the day because sometimes they run out of dough, which will break your heart. By 1 p.m., the streets outside the pizzeria have become jammed with Neapolitans trying to get into the place, shoving for access like they're trying to get space on a lifeboat. There's not a menu. They have only two varieties of pizza here, regular and extra cheese. None of this new-age Southern California olives and sun-dried tomato wannabe pizza twaddle. The dough, it takes me half my meal to figure out, tastes more like Indian naan than like any pizza dough I've ever tried. It's soft and chewy and yielding but incredibly thin. I always thought we only had two choices in our lives when it came to pizza crust, thin and crispy or thick and doughy. How was I to have known that there could be a crust in this world that was thin and doughy? Holy of holies, thin, doughy, strong, gummy, yummy, chewy, salty pizza paradise. On top, there is a sweet tomato sauce that foams up all bubbly and creamy when it melts the fresh buffalo mozzarella, and the one sprig of basil in the middle of the whole deal somehow infuses the entire pizza with herbal radiance, much the same way one shimmering movie star in the middle of a party brings a contact high of glamour to everyone around her. It's technically impossible to eat this thing, of course. You try to take a bite off your slice, and the gummy crust folds, and the hot cheese runs away like topsoil in a landslide, makes a mess of you and your surroundings, but just deal with it. The guys who make this miracle happen are shoveling the pizzas in and out of the wood-burning oven, looking for all the world like the boiler men in the belly of a great ship who shovel coal into the raging furnaces. Their sleeves are rolled up over their sweaty forearms, their faces red with exertion, one eye squinted against the heat of the fire and a cigarette dangling from the lips. Sophie and I each order another pie, another whole pizza each, and Sophie tries to pull herself together, but really, the pizza is so good, we can barely cope. A word about my body. I am gaining weight every day, of course. I am doing rude things to my body here in Italy, taking in such ghastly amounts of cheese and pasta and bread and wine and chocolate and pizza dough. Elsewhere in Naples, I've been told, you can actually get something called chocolate pizza. What kind of nonsense is that? I mean, later I did go find some, and it's delicious, but honestly, chocolate pizza? I'm not exercising, I'm not eating enough fiber, I'm not taking any vitamins. In my real life, I have been known to eat organic goat's milk yogurt sprinkled with wheat germ for breakfast. My real life days are long gone. Back in America, my friend Susan is telling people I'm on a no-carb left-behind tour. But my body is being such a good sport about all this. My body is turning a blind eye to my misdoings and my overindulgences as if to say, "Okay, kid, live it up. I recognize that this is just temporary. Let me know when your little experiment with pure pleasure is over and I'll see what I can do about damage control." Still, when I look at myself in the mirror of the best pizzeria in Naples, I see a bright-eyed, clear-skinned, happy, and healthy face. I haven't seen a face like that on me for a long time. "Thank you," I whisper. Then Sophie and I run out in the rain to look for pastries. 28. It is this happiness, I suppose, which is really a few months old by now, that gets me to thinking upon my return to Rome that I need to do something about David. That maybe it's time for us to end our story forever. We were already separated, that was official, but there was still a window of hope left open that perhaps someday, maybe after my travels, maybe after a year apart, we could give things another try. We loved each other. That was never the question. It's just that we couldn't figure out how to stop making each other desperately, shriekingly, soul-punishingly miserable. Last spring, David had offered this crazy solution to our woes, only half in jest. What if we just acknowledged that we have a bad relationship and we stuck it out anyway? What if we admitted that we make each other nuts, we fight constantly, hardly ever have sex, but we can't live without each other, so we deal with it? And then we could spend our lives together in misery, but happy to not be apart. Let it be a testimony to how desperately I love this guy that I have spent the last 10 months giving that offer serious consideration. The other alternative in the backs of our minds, of course, was that one of us might change. He might become more open and affectionate, not withholding himself from anyone who loves him on the fear that she will eat his soul. Or I might learn how to stop trying to eat his soul. So many times I had wished with David that I could behave more like my mother does in her marriage, independent, strong, self-sufficient, a self-feeder, able to exist without regular doses of romance or flattery from my solitary farmer of a father, able to cheerfully plant gardens of daisies among the inexplicable stone walls of silence that my dad sometimes builds up around himself. My dad is quite simply my favorite person in the world, but he is a bit of an odd case. An ex-boyfriend of mine once described him this way: "Your father has only one foot on this earth, and really, really long legs." What I grew up watching in my household was a mother who would receive her husband's love and affection whenever he thought to offer it, but would then step aside and take care of herself whenever he drifted off into his own peculiar universe of low-grade, oblivious neglect. This is how it looked to me, anyway, taking into account that nobody, and especially not the children, ever knows the secrets of a marriage. What I believed I grew up seeing was a mother who asked nothing of anybody. This was my mom, after all, a woman who had taught herself how to swim as an adolescent alone in a cold Minnesota lake with a book she'd borrowed from the local library entitled How to Swim. To my eye, there was nothing this woman could not do on her own. But then I'd had a revelatory conversation with my mother not long before I'd left for Rome. She'd come to New York to have one last lunch with me, and she'd asked me frankly, breaking all the rules of communication in our family's history, what had happened between me and David. Further disregarding the Gilbert Family Standard Communications rulebook, I actually told her. I told her everything. I told her how much I loved David, but how lonely and heartsick it made me to be with this person who was always disappearing from the room, from the bed, from the planet. "He sounds kind of like your father," she said, a brave and generous admission. "The problem is," I said, "I'm not like my mother. I'm not as tough as you, Mom. There's a constant level of closeness that I really need from the person I love. I wish I could be more like you, then I could have this love story with David, but it just destroys me not to be able to count on that affection when I need it." Then my mother shocked me. She said, "All those things that you want from your relationship, Liz, I have always wanted those things too." In that moment, it was as if my strong mother reached across the table, opened her fist, and finally showed me the handful of bullets she'd had to bite over the decades in order to stay happily married, and she is happily married, all considerations weighed, to my father. I had never seen this side of her before, not ever. I had never imagined what she might have wanted, what she might have been missing, what she might have decided not to fight for in the larger scheme of things. Seeing all this, I could feel my worldview start to make a radical shift. If even she wants what I want, then... Continuing with this unprecedented string of intimacies, my mother said, "You have to understand how little I was raised to expect that I deserved in life, honey. Remember, I come from a different time and place than you do." I closed my eyes and saw my mother, 10 years old, on the family farm in Minnesota, working like a hired hand, raising her younger brothers, wearing the clothes of her older sister, saving dimes to get herself out of there. "And you have to understand how much I love your father," she concluded. My mother has made choices in her life, as we all must, and she is at peace with them. I can see her peace. She did not cop out on herself. The benefits of her choices are massive. A long, stable marriage to a man she still calls her best friend, a family that has extended now into grandchildren who adore her, a certainty in her own strength. Maybe some things were sacrificed, and my dad made his sacrifices too. But who amongst us lives without sacrifice? And the question now for me is, what are my choices to be? What do I believe that I deserve in this life? Where can I accept sacrifice, and where can I not? It has been so hard for me to imagine living a life without David in it. Even just to imagine that there will never be another road trip with my favorite traveling companion, that I will never again pull up at his curb with the windows down and Springsteen playing on the radio, a lifetime supply of banter and snacks between us, and an ocean destination looming down the highway. But how can I accept that bliss when it comes with this dark underside, bone-crushing isolation, corrosive insecurity, insidious resentment, and, of course, the complete dismantling of self that inevitably occurs when David ceases to giveth and commences to taketh away. I can't do it anymore. Something about my recent joy in Naples has made me certain that I not only can find happiness without David, but must. No matter how much I love him, and I do love him in stupid excess, I have to say goodbye to this person now, and I have to make it stick. So I write him an email. It's November. We haven't had any communication since July. I'd asked him not to get in touch with me while I was traveling, knowing that my attachment to him was so strong it would be impossible for me to focus on my journey if I were also tracking his. But now I'm entering his life again with this email. I tell him that I hope he's well, and I report that I am well. I make a few jokes. We were always good with the jokes. Then I explain that I think we really need to put an end to this relationship for good, that maybe it's time to admit that it will never happen, that it should never happen. The note isn't overly dramatic. Lord knows we've had enough drama together already. I keep it short and simple. But there's one more thing I need to add. Holding my breath, I type, "If you want to look for another partner in your life, of course you have nothing but my blessings." My hands are shaking. I sign off with love, trying to keep as cheerful a tone as possible. I feel like I just got hit in the chest with a stick. I don't sleep much that night, imagining him reading my words. I run back to the internet cafe a few times throughout the next day, looking for a response. I'm trying to ignore the part of me that is dying to find that he has replied, "Come back, don't go, I'll change." I'm trying to disregard the girl in me who would happily drop this whole grand idea of traveling around the world in simple exchange for the keys to David's apartment. But around 10 o'clock that night, I finally get my answer. A wonderfully written email, of course. David always wrote wonderfully. He agrees that, yes, it's time we really said goodbye forever. He's been thinking along the same lines himself, he says. He couldn't be more gracious in his response, and he shares his own feelings of loss and regret with that high tenderness he was sometimes so achingly capable of reaching. He hopes that I know how much he adores me, beyond even his ability to find words to express it. "But we are not what the other one needs," he says. Still, he is certain that I will find great love in my life someday. He's sure of it. "After all," he says, "beauty attracts beauty." Which is a lovely thing to say, truly. Which is just about the loveliest thing that the love of your life could ever possibly say when he's not saying, "Come back, don't go, I'll change." I sit there staring at the computer screen in silence for a long, sad time. It's all for the best, I know it is. I'm choosing happiness over suffering, I know I am. I'm making space for the unknown future to fill up my life with yet-to-come surprises, I know all this. But still, it's David, lost to me now. I drop my face in my hands for a longer and even sadder time. Finally, I look up, only to see that one of the Albanian women who work at the internet cafe has paused from her night shift mopping of the floor to lean against the wall and watch me. We hold our tired gazes on each other for a moment. Then I give her a grim shake of my head and say aloud, "This blows ass." She nods sympathetically. She doesn't understand, but of course, in her way, she understands completely. My cell phone rings. It's Giovanni. He sounds confused. He says he's been waiting for me for over an hour in the Piazza Fiume, which is where we always meet on Thursday nights for language exchange. He's bewildered because normally he's the one who's late or who forgets to show up for our appointments. But he got there right on time tonight for once, and he was pretty sure. Didn't we have a date? I'd forgotten. I tell him where I am. He says he'll come pick me up in his car. I'm not in the mood for seeing anybody, but it's too hard to explain this over the telefonino, given our limited language skills. I go wait outside in the cold for him. A few minutes later, his little red car pulls up, and I climb in. He asks me in slangy Italian, "What's up?" I open my mouth to answer and collapse into tears. I mean, wailing. I mean, that terrible, ragged breed of bawling my friend Sally calls double pumping it, when you have to inhale two desperate gasps of oxygen with every sob. I never even saw this grief quake coming. Got totally blindsided by it. Poor Giovanni. He asks in halting English if he did something wrong. Am I mad at him, maybe? Did he hurt my feelings? I can't answer, but only shake my head and keep howling. I'm so mortified with myself and so sorry for poor dear Giovanni trapped here in this car with this sobbing, incoherent old woman who is totally a pezzi, in pieces. I finally manage to rasp out an assurance that my distress has nothing to do with him. I choke forth an apology for being such a mess. Giovanni takes charge of the situation in a manner far beyond his years. He says, "Do not apologize for crying. Without this emotion, we are only robots." He gives me some tissues from a box in the back of the car. He says, "Let's drive." He's right. The front of this internet cafe is far too public and brightly lit a place to fall apart. He drives for a bit, then pulls the car over in the center of the Piazza della Repubblica, one of Rome's more noble open spaces. He parks in front of that gorgeous fountain with the bodacious naked nymphs cavorting so pornographically with their phallic flock of stiff-necked giant swans. This fountain was built fairly recently by Roman standards. According to my guidebook, the women who modeled for the nymphs were a pair of sisters, two popular burlesque dancers of their day. They gained a fair bit of notoriety when the fountain was completed. The church tried for months to prevent the thing from being unveiled because it was too sexy. The sisters lived well into old age, and even as late as the 1920s, these two dignified old ladies could be seen walking together every day into the piazza to have a look at their fountain. And every year, once a year, for as long as he lived, the French sculptor who had captured them in marble during their prime would come to Rome and take the sisters out to lunch, where they would reminisce together about the days when they were all so young and beautiful and wild. So Giovanni parks there and waits for me to get a hold of myself. All I can do is press the heels of my palms against my eyes, trying to push the tears back in. We have never once had a personal conversation, me and Giovanni. All these months, all these dinners together, all we have ever talked about is philosophy and art and culture and politics and food. We know nothing of each other's private lives. He does not even know that I am divorced or that I have left love behind in America. I do not know a thing about him, except that he wants to be a writer and that he was born in Naples. My crying, though, is about to force a whole new level of conversation between these two people. I wish it wouldn't, not under these dreadful circumstances. He says, "I'm sorry, but I don't understand. Did you lose something today?" But I'm still having trouble figuring out how to talk. Giovanni smiles and says encouragingly, "Parlo come mangi." He knows this is one of my favorite expressions in Roman dialect. It means, "Speak the way you eat," or, in my personal translation, "Say it like you eat it." It's a reminder when you're making a big deal out of explaining something, when you're searching for the right words, to keep your language as simple and direct as Roman food. Don't make a big production out of it. Just lay it on the table. I take a deep breath and offer a heavily abridged, yet somehow totally complete, Italian language version of my situation. "It's about a love story, Giovanni. I had to say goodbye to somebody today." Then my hands are slapped over my eyes again, tears spraying through my clamped fingers. Bless his heart, Giovanni doesn't try to put a reassuring arm around me, nor does he express the slightest discomfort about my explosion of sadness. Instead, he just sits through my tears in silence until I've calmed down, at which point he speaks with perfect empathy, choosing each word with care. As his English teacher, I was so proud of him that night, saying slowly and clearly and kindly, "I understand, Liz. I have been there." 29. My sister's arrival in Rome a few days later helped nudge my attention away from lingering sadness over David and bring me back up to speed. My sister does everything fast, and energy twists up around her in miniature cyclones. She's 3 years older than me and 3 inches taller than me. She's an athlete and a scholar and a mother and a writer. The whole time she was in Rome, she was training for a marathon, which means she would wake up at dawn and run 18 miles in the time it generally takes me to read one article in the newspaper and drink two cappuccinos. She actually looks like a deer when she runs. When she was pregnant with her first child, she swam across an entire lake one night in the dark. I wouldn't join her, and I wasn't even pregnant. I was too scared. But my sister doesn't really get scared. When she was pregnant with her second child, a midwife asked if Catherine had any unspoken fears about anything that could go wrong with the baby, such as genetic defects or complications during the birth. My sister said, "My only fear is that he might grow up to become a Republican." That's my sister's name, Catherine. She's my one and only sibling. When we were growing up in rural Connecticut, it was just the two of us, living in a farmhouse with our parents, no other kids nearby. She was mighty and domineering, the commander of my whole life. I lived in awe and fear of her. Nobody else's opinion mattered but hers. I cheated at card games with her in order to lose so she wouldn't get mad at me. We were not always friends. She was annoyed by me and I was scared of her, I believe, until I was 28 years old and got tired of it. That was the year I finally stood up to her, and her reaction was something along the lines of, "What took you so long?" We were just beginning to hammer out the new terms of our relationship when my marriage went into a skid. It would have been so easy for Catherine to have gained victory from my defeat. I'd always been the loved and lucky one, the favorite of both family and destiny. The world had always been a more comfortable and welcoming place for me than it was for my sister, who pressed so sharply against life and who was hurt by it fairly hard sometimes in return. It would have been so easy for Catherine to have responded to my divorce and depression with a, "Ha! Look at little Mary Sunshine now!" Instead, she held me up like a champion. She answered the phone in the middle of the night whenever I was in distress and made comforting noises. And she came along with me when I went searching for answers as to why I was so sad. For the longest time, my therapy was almost vicariously shared by her. I'd call her after every session with a debriefing of everything I'd realized in my therapist's office, and she'd put down whatever she was doing and say, "Ah, that explains a lot." Explains a lot about both of us, that is. Now we speak to each other on the phone almost every day, or at least we did before I moved to Rome. Before either of us gets on an airplane now, the one always calls the other and says, "I know this is morbid, but I just wanted to tell you that I love you, you know, just in case." And the other one always says, "I know, just in case." She arrives in Rome prepared as ever. She brings 5 guidebooks, all of which she has read already, and she has the city pre-mapped in her head. She was completely oriented before she even left Philadelphia. And this is a classic example of the differences between us. I am the one who spent my first weeks in Rome wandering about, 90% lost and 100% happy, seeing everything around me as an unexplainable, beautiful mystery. But this is how the world kind of always looks to me. To my sister's eyes, there is nothing which cannot be explained, if one has access to a proper reference library. This is a woman who keeps the Columbia Encyclopedia in her kitchen, next to the cookbooks, and reads it for pleasure. There's a game I like to play with my friends sometimes called Watch This. Whenever anybody's wondering about some obscure fact, for instance, who was St. Louis, I will say, "Watch this," then pick up the nearest phone and dial my sister's number. Sometimes I'll catch her in the car, driving her kids home from school in the Volvo, and she will muse, "San Louis, well, he was a hair shirt wearing French king, actually, which is interesting because..." So my sister comes to visit me in Rome, in my new city, and then shows it to me. This is Rome, Catherine style, full of facts and dates and architecture that I do not see because my mind does not work in that way. The only thing I ever want to know about any place or any person is the story. This is the only thing I watch for, never for aesthetic details. Sophie came to my apartment a month after I'd moved into the place and said, "Nice pink bathroom." And this was the first time I'd noticed that it was, indeed, pink, bright pink, from floor to ceiling, bright pink tile everywhere. I honestly hadn't seen it before. But my sister's trained eye picks up the Gothic or Romanesque or Byzantine features of a building, the pattern of the church floor, or the dim sketch of the unfinished fresco hidden behind the altar. She strides across Rome on her long legs. We used to call her Catherine of the 3-foot-long femurs, and I hasten after her, as I have since toddlerhood, taking 2 eager steps to her every one. "See, Liz," she says, "see how they just slapped that 19th-century facade over that brickwork? I bet if we turn the corner we'll find, yet, see, they did use the original Roman monoliths as supporting beams, probably because they didn't have the manpower to move them. Yes, I quite like the jumble sale quality of this basilica." Catherine carries the map and her Michelin green guide, and I carry our picnic lunch. 2 of those big softball-sized rolls of bread, spicy sausage, pickled sardines wrapped around meaty green olives, a mushroom pâté that tastes like a forest, balls of smoked mozzarella, peppered and grilled arugula, cherry tomatoes, pecorino cheese, mineral water, and a split of cold white wine. And while I wonder when we're going to eat, she wonders aloud, why don't people talk more about the Council of Trent? She takes me into dozens of churches in Rome, and I can't keep them straight. Saint this and saint that and saint somebody of the barefoot penitence of righteous misery. But just because I cannot remember the names or details of all these buttresses and cornices is not to say that I do not love to be inside these places with my sister, whose cobalt eyes miss nothing. I don't remember the name of the church that had those frescoes that looked so much like American WPA New Deal heroic murals, but I do remember Catherine pointing them out to me and saying, "You gotta love those Franklin Roosevelt popes up there." I also remember the morning we woke early and went to Mass at St. Susanna and held each other's hands as we listened to the nuns there chanting their daybreak Gregorian hymns, both of us in tears from the echoing haunt of their prayers. My sister is not a religious person. Nobody in my family really is. I've taken to calling myself the white sheep of the family. My spiritual investigations interest my sister mostly from a point of intellectual curiosity. "I think that kind of faith is so beautiful," she whispers to me in the church, "but I can't do it. I just can't." Here's another example of the difference in our worldviews. A family in my sister's neighborhood was recently stricken with a double tragedy when both the young mother and her 3-year-old son were diagnosed with cancer. When Catherine told me about this, I could only say, shocked, "Dear God, that family needs grace." She replied firmly, "That family needs casseroles," and then proceeded to organize the entire neighborhood into bringing that family dinner in shifts every single night for an entire year. I do not know if my sister fully recognizes that this is grace. We walk out of St. Susanna, and she says, "Do you know why the popes needed city planning in the Middle Ages? Because basically you had 2 million Catholic pilgrims a year coming from all over the Western world to make that walk from the Vatican to St. John Lateran, sometimes on their knees, and you had to have amenities for those people." My sister's faith is in learning. Her sacred text is the Oxford English Dictionary. As she bows her head in study, fingers speeding across the pages, she is with her God. I see my sister in prayer again later that same day, when she drops to her knees in the middle of the Roman Forum, clears away some litter off the face of the soil, as though erasing a blackboard, then takes up a small stone and draws for me in the dirt a blueprint of a classic Romanesque basilica. She points from her drawing to the ruin before her, leading me to understand, even visually challenged me can understand, what that building once must have looked like 18 centuries earlier. She sketches with her finger in the empty air the missing arches, the nave, the windows long gone. Like Harold with his purple crayon, she fills in the absent cosmos with her imagination and makes whole the ruined. In Italian, there is a seldom used tense called the passato remoto, the remote past. You use this tense when you are discussing things in the far, far distant past, things that happened so long ago they have no personal impact whatsoever on you anymore. For example, ancient history. But my sister, if she spoke Italian, would not use this tense to discuss ancient history. In her world, the Roman Forum is not remote, nor is it past. It is exactly as present and close to her as I am. She leaves the next day. "Listen," I say, "be sure to call me when your plane lands safely, okay? Not to be morbid, but..." "I know, sweetie," she says. "I love you, too." 30. I am so surprised sometimes to notice that my sister is a wife and a mother, and I am not. Somehow I always thought it would be the opposite. I thought it would be me who would end up with a house full of muddy boots and hollering kids, while Catherine would be living by herself, a solo act, reading alone at night in her bed. We grew up into different adults than anyone might have foretold when we were children. It's better this way, though, I think. Against all predictions, we've each created lives that tally with us. Her solitary nature means that she needs a family to keep her from loneliness. My gregarious nature means that I will never have to worry about being alone, even when I am single. I'm happy that she's going back home to her family, and also happy that I have another 9 months of traveling ahead of me, where all I have to do is eat and read and pray and write. I still can't say whether I will ever want children. I was astonished to find that I did not want them at 30. The remembrance of that surprise cautions me against placing any bets on how I will feel at 40. I can only say how I feel now, grateful to be on my own. I also know that I won't go forth and have children just in case I might regret missing it later in life. I don't think this is a strong enough motivation to bring more babies onto the earth. Though I suppose people do reproduce sometimes for that reason, for insurance against later regret. I think people have children for all manner of reasons, sometimes out of a pure desire to nurture and witness life, sometimes out of an absence of choice, sometimes in order to hold on to a partner or create an heir, sometimes without thinking about it in any particular way. Not all the reasons to have children are the same, and not all of them are necessarily unselfish. Not all the reasons not to have children are the same either, though, nor are all those reasons necessarily selfish. I say this because I'm still working out that accusation, which was leveled against me many times by my husband as our marriage was collapsing, selfishness. Every time he said it, I agreed completely, accepted the guilt, bought everything in the store. My God, I hadn't even had the babies yet, and I was already neglecting them, already choosing myself over them. I was already a bad mother. These babies, these phantom babies, came up a lot in our arguments. Who would take care of the babies? Who would stay home with the babies? Who would financially support the babies? Who would feed the babies in the middle of the night? I remember saying once to my friend Susan when my marriage was becoming intolerable, "I don't want my children growing up in a household like this." Susan said, "Why don't you leave those so-called children out of the discussion? They don't even exist yet, Liz. Why don't you just admit that you don't want to live in unhappiness anymore, that neither of you does? And it's better to realize it now, by the way, than in the delivery room when you're at 5 centimeters. I remember going to a party in New York around that time. A couple, a pair of successful artists, had just had a baby, and the mother was celebrating a gallery opening of her new paintings. I remember watching this woman, the new mother, my friend, the artist, as she tried to be hostess to this party, which was in her loft, at the same time as taking care of her infant and trying to discuss her work professionally. I never saw somebody look so sleep-deprived in my life. I can never forget the image of her standing in her kitchen after midnight, elbows deep in a sink full of dishes, trying to clean up after this event. Her husband, I am sorry to report it, and I fully realize this is not at all representational of every husband, was in the other room, feet literally on the coffee table, watching TV. She finally asked him if he would help clean the kitchen, and he said, "Leave it, hon. We'll clean it up in the morning." The baby started crying again. My friend was leaking breast milk through her cocktail dress. Almost certainly, other people who attended this party came away with different images than I did. Any number of the other guests could have felt great envy for this beautiful woman with her healthy new baby, for her successful artistic career, for her marriage to a nice man, for her lovely apartment, for her cocktail dress. There were people at this party who would probably have traded lives with her in an instant, given the chance. This woman herself probably looks back on that evening, if she ever thinks of it at all, as one tiring but totally worth it night in her overall satisfying life of motherhood and marriage and career. All I can say for myself, though, is that I spent that whole party trembling in panic, thinking, "If you don't recognize that this is your future, Liz, then you are out of your mind. Do not let it happen." But did I have a responsibility to have a family? Oh, Lord, responsibility. That word worked on me until I worked on it, until I looked at it carefully and broke it down into the two words that make its true definition, the ability to respond. And what I ultimately had to respond to was the reality that every speck of my being was telling me to get out of my marriage. Somewhere inside me, an early warning system was forecasting that if I kept trying to white-knuckle my way through this storm, I would end up getting cancer. And that if I brought children into the world anyway, just because I didn't want to deal with the hassle or shame of revealing some impractical facts about myself, this would be an act of grievous irresponsibility. In the end, though, I was most guided by something my friend Cheryl said to me that very night, at that very party, when she found me hiding in the bathroom of our friend's fancy loft, shaking in fear, splashing water on my face. Cheryl didn't know then what was going on in my marriage. Nobody did. And I didn't tell her that night. All I could say was, I don't know what to do. I remember her taking me by the shoulders and looking me in the eye with a calm smile and saying simply, tell the truth, tell the truth, tell the truth. So that's what I tried to do. Getting out of a marriage is rough, though, and not just for the legal financial complications or the massive lifestyle upheaval. As my friend Deborah once advised me wisely, nobody ever died from splitting up furniture. It's the emotional recoil that kills you, the shock of stepping off the track of a conventional lifestyle and losing all the embracing comforts that keep so many people on that track forever. To create a family with a spouse is one of the most fundamental ways a person can find continuity and meaning in American or any society. I rediscover this truth every time I go to a big reunion of my mother's family in Minnesota, and I see how everyone is held so reassuringly in their positions over the years. First, you are a child, then you are a teenager, then you are a young married person, then you are a parent, then you are retired, then you are a grandparent. At every stage, you know who you are, you know what your duty is, and you know where to sit at the reunion. You sit with the other children or teenagers or young parents or retirees until at last you are sitting with the 90-year-olds in the shade watching over your progeny with satisfaction. Who are you? No problem. You're the person who created all this. The satisfaction of this knowledge is immediate, and moreover, it's universally recognized. How many people have I heard claim their children as the greatest accomplishment and comfort of their lives? It's the thing they can always lean on during a metaphysical crisis or a moment of doubt about their relevancy. If I have done nothing else in this life, then at least I have raised my children well. But what if, either by choice or by reluctant necessity, you end up not participating in this comforting cycle of family and continuity? What if you step out? Where do you sit at the reunion? How do you mark time's passage without the fear that you've just frittered away your time on earth without being relevant? You'll need to find another purpose, another measure by which to judge whether or not you have been a successful human being. I love children, but what if I don't have any? What kind of person does that make me? Virginia Woolf wrote, "Across the broad continent of a woman's life falls the shadow of a sword. On one side of that sword," she said, "there lies convention and tradition and order where all is correct. But on the other side of that sword, if you're crazy enough to cross it and choose a life that does not follow convention, all is confusion. Nothing follows a regular course." Her argument was that the crossing of the shadow of that sword may bring a far more interesting existence to a woman, but you can bet it will also be more perilous. I'm lucky that at least I have my writing. This is something people can understand. Ah, she left her marriage in order to preserve her art. That's sort of true, though not completely so. A lot of writers have families. Toni Morrison, just to name an example, didn't let the raising of her son stop her from winning a little trinket we call the Nobel Prize. But Toni Morrison made her own path, and I must make mine. The Bhagavad Gita, that ancient Indian yogic text, says that it is better to live your own destiny imperfectly than to live in imitation of somebody else's life with perfection. So now I have started living my own life, imperfect and clumsy as it may look. It is resembling me now, thoroughly. Anyway, I bring all this up only to admit that, in comparison to my sister's existence, to her home and to her good marriage and to her children, I'm looking pretty unstable these days. I don't even have an address, and that's kind of a crime against normality at this ripe old age of 34. Even at this very moment, all my belongings are stored in Catherine's home, and she's given me a temporary bedroom on the top floor of her house, which we call the Maiden Aunt's Quarters, as it includes a garret window through which I can stare out at the moors while dressed in my old wedding gown, grieving my lost youth. Catherine seems to be fine with this arrangement, and it's certainly convenient for me, but I'm wary of the danger that if I drift about this world randomly for too long, I may someday become the family flake. Or it may have already happened. Last summer, my 5-year-old niece had a little friend over to my sister's house to play. I asked the child when her birthday was. She told me it was January 25th. Uh-oh, I said. You're an Aquarius. I've dated enough Aquarians to know that they are trouble. Both the 5-year-olds looked at me with bewilderment and a little bit of fearful uncertainty, and I had a sudden horrifying image of the woman I might become if I'm not careful. Crazy Aunt Liz, the divorcee in the moo-moo with the dyed orange hair, who doesn't eat dairy but smokes menthols, who's always just coming back from her astrology cruise or breaking up with her aromatherapist boyfriend, who reads the tarot cards of kindergartners, and who says things like, "Bring Annie Liz another wine cooler, baby, and I'll let you wear my mood ring." Eventually, I may have to become a more solid citizen again. I'm aware of this. But not yet. Please. Not just yet. 31. Over the next 6 weeks, I traveled to Bologna, to Florence, to Venice, to Sicily, to Sardinia, and once more down to Naples, and then over to Calabria. These are short trips, mostly, a week here, a weekend there, just the right amount of time to get the feel for a place, to look around, to ask people on the street where the good food is, and then go eat it. I drop out of my Italian language school, having come to feel that it was interfering with my efforts to learn Italian, since it was keeping me stuck in the classroom instead of wandering around Italy, where I could practice with people in person. These weeks of spontaneous travel are such a glorious twirl of time, some of the loosest days of my life, running to the train station and buying tickets left and right, finally beginning to flex my freedom for real because it has finally sunk in that I can go wherever I want. I don't see my friends in Rome for a while. Giovanni tells me over the phone, "Sei una trottola, you're a spinning top." One night in a town somewhere on the Mediterranean, in a hotel room by the ocean, the sound of my own laughter actually wakes me up in the middle of my deep sleep. I am startled. Who is that laughing in my bed? The realization that it is only me just makes me laugh again. I can't remember now what I was dreaming. I think maybe it had something to do with boats. 32. Florence is just a weekend, a quick train ride up on a Friday morning to visit my Uncle Terry and Aunt Deb, who have flown in from Connecticut to visit Italy for the first time in their lives, and to see their niece, of course. It is evening when they arrive, and I take them on a walk to look at the Duomo, always such an impressive sight, as evidenced by my uncle's reaction. "Oy vey," he says, then pauses and adds, "Or maybe that's the wrong word for praising a Catholic church." We watch the Sabines getting raped right there in the middle of the sculpture garden with nobody doing a damn thing to stop it, and pay our respects to Michelangelo, to the Science Museum, to the views from the hillsides around town. Then I leave my aunt and uncle to enjoy the rest of their vacation without me, and I go on alone to wealthy, ample Lucca, that little Tuscan town with its celebrated butcher shops, where the finest cuts of meat I've seen in all of Italy are displayed with a you-know-you-want-it sensuality in shops across town. Sausages of every imaginable size, color, and derivation are stuffed like ladies' legs into provocative stockings, swinging from the ceilings of the butcher shops. Lusty buttocks of hams hang in the windows, beckoning like Amsterdam's high-end hookers. The chickens look so plump and contented, even in death, that you imagine they offered themselves up for sacrifice proudly, after competing amongst themselves in life, to see who could become the moistest and the fattest. But it's not just the meat that's wonderful in Lucca, it's the chestnuts, the peaches, the tumbling displays of figs. Dear God, the figs. The town is famous too, of course, for having been the birthplace of Puccini. I know I should probably be interested in this, but I'm much more interested in the secret a local grocer has shared with me, that the best mushrooms in town are served in a restaurant across from Puccini's birthplace. So I wander through Lucca, asking directions in Italian, "Can you tell me where is the house of Puccini?" And a kind civilian finally leads me right to it, and then is probably very surprised when I say grazie, then turn on my heel and march in the exact opposite direction of the museum's entrance, entering a restaurant across the street and waiting out the rain over my serving of risotto ai funghi. I don't recall now if it was before or after Lucca that I went to Bologna, a city so beautiful that I couldn't stop singing the whole time I was there. My Bologna has a first name. It's P-R-E-T-T-Y. Traditionally, Bologna, with its lovely brick architecture and famous wealth, has been called the Red, the Fat, and the Beautiful. And yes, that was an alternate title for this book. The food is definitely better here than in Rome, or maybe they just use more butter. Even the gelato in Bologna is better, and I feel somewhat disloyal saying that, but it's true. The mushrooms here are like big, thick, sexy tongues, and the prosciutto drapes over pizzas like a fine lace veil draping over a fancy lady's hat. And, of course, there's the bolognese sauce, which laughs disdainfully at any other idea of a ragu. It occurs to me in Bologna that there is no equivalent in English for the term buon appetito. This is a pity, and also very telling. It occurs to me, too, that the train stops of Italy are a tour through the names of the world's most famous foods and wines. Next stop, Parma. Next stop, Bologna. Next stop, approaching Montepulciano. Inside the trains, there is food, too, of course. Little sandwiches and good hot chocolate. If it's raining outside, it's even nicer to snack and speed along. For one long ride, I share a train compartment with a good-looking young Italian guy who sleeps for hours through the rain as I eat my octopus salad. The guy wakes up shortly before we arrive in Venice, rubs his eyes, looks me over from foot to head, and pronounces under his breath, Carina, which means cute. Grazie mille, I tell him with exaggerated politeness. A thousand thanks. He's surprised. He didn't realize I spoke Italian. Neither did I, actually. But we talk for about 20 minutes, and I realize for the first time that I do. Some line has been crossed, and I'm actually speaking Italian now. I'm not translating, I'm talking. Of course, there's a mistake in every sentence, and I only know three tenses, but I can communicate with this guy without much effort. Me la cavo is how you would say it in Italian, which basically means I can get by, but comes from the same verb you use to talk about uncorking a bottle of wine, meaning I can use this language to extract myself from tight situations. He's hitting on me, this kid. It's not entirely unflattering. He's not entirely unattractive, though he's not remotely uncocky either. At one point, he says to me in Italian, meaning to be complimentary, of course, "You're not too fat for an American woman." I reply in English, "And you're not too greasy for an Italian man." "Come?" I repeat myself in slightly modified Italian. "And you're so gracious, just like all Italian men." I can speak this language. The kid thinks I like him, but it's the words I'm flirting with. My God, I have decanted myself. I have uncorked my tongue, and Italian is pouring forth. He wants me to meet him later in Venice, but I don't have the first interest in him. I'm just lovesick over the language, so I let him slide away. Anyhow, I've already got a date in Venice. I'm meeting my friend Linda there. Crazy Linda, as I like to call her, even though she isn't, is coming to Venice from Seattle, another damp and gray town. She wanted to come see me in Italy, so I invited her along on this leg of my trip, because I refuse, I absolutely decline, to go to the most romantic city on earth by myself. No, not now, not this year. I could just picture myself all alone in the butt end of a gondola, getting dragged through the mist by a crooning gondolier as I read a magazine. It's a sad image. Rather like the idea of humping up a hill all by yourself on a bicycle built for two. So Linda will provide me with company, and good company at that. I met Linda and her dreadlocks and her piercings in Bali almost 2 years ago when I went for that yoga retreat. Since then, we've done a trip to Costa Rica, too. She's one of my favorite traveling companions, an unflappable and entertaining and surprisingly organized little pixie in tight red crushed velvet pants. Linda is the owner of one of the world's more intact psyches, with an incomprehension for depression and a self-esteem that has never even considered being anything but high. She said to me once while regarding herself in the mirror, "Admittedly, I am not the one who looks fantastic in everything, but still, I cannot help loving myself." She's got this ability to shut me up when I start fretting over metaphysical questions, such as, what is the nature of the universe? Linda's reply, "My only question is, why ask?" Linda would like to someday grow her dreadlocks so long she could weave them into a wire-supported structure on the top of her head, like a topiary, and maybe store birds in there. The Balinese loved Linda. So did the Costa Ricans. When she's not taking care of her pet lizards and ferrets, she is managing a software development team in Seattle and making more money than any of us. So we find each other there in Venice, and Linda frowns at our map of the city, turns it upside down, locates our hotel, orients herself, and announces with characteristic humility, "We are the mayors of this town's ass." Her cheer, her optimism, they in no way match this stinky, slow, sinking, mysterious, silent, weird city. Venice seems like a wonderful city in which to die a slow and alcoholic death, or to lose a loved one, or to lose the murder weapon with which the loved one was lost in the first place. Seeing Venice, I'm grateful that I chose to live in Rome instead. I don't think I would have gotten off the antidepressants quite so quick here. Venice is beautiful, but like a Bergman movie is beautiful. You can admire it, but you don't really want to live in it. The whole town is peeling and fading like those suites of rooms that once rich families will barricade away in the backs of their mansions when it gets too expensive to keep the maintenance up, and it's easier to just nail the doors shut and forget about the dying treasures on the other side. This is Venice. Greasy streams of Adriatic backwash nudge up against the long-suffering foundations of these buildings, testing the endurance of this 14th-century science fair experiment. Hey, what if we built a city that sits in water all the time? Venice is spooky under its grainy November skies. The city creaks and sways like a fishing pier. Despite Linda's initial confidence that we can govern this town, we get lost every day, and most especially at night, taking wrong turns toward dark corners that dead-end dangerously and directly into canal water. One foggy night, we pass an old building that seems to actually be groaning in pain. "Not to worry," chirps Linda. "That's just Satan's hungry maw." I teach her my favorite Italian word, attraversiamo, let's cross over, and we backtrack nervously out of there. The beautiful young Venetian woman who owns the restaurant near where we are staying is miserable with her fate. She hates Venice. She swears that everyone who lives in Venice regards it as a tomb. She'd fallen in love once with a Sardinian artist who'd promised her another world of light and sun, but had left her instead with three children and no choice but to return to Venice and run the family restaurant. She is my age, but looks even older than I do, and I can't imagine the kind of man who could do that to a woman so attractive. "He was powerful," she says, "and I died of love in his shadow." Venice is conservative. The woman has had some affairs here, maybe even with some married men, but it always ends in sorrow. The neighbors talk about her. People stop speaking when she walks into the room. Her mother begs her to wear a wedding ring just for appearances, saying, "Darling, this is not Rome, where you can live as scandalously as you like." Every morning, when Linda and I come for breakfast and ask our sorrowful young old Venetian proprietress about the weather report for the day, she cocks the fingers of her right hand like a gun, puts it to her temple, and says, "More rain." Yet, I don't get depressed here. I can cope with and even somehow enjoy the sinking melancholy of Venice just for a few days. Somewhere in me, I am able to recognize that this is not my melancholy. This is the city's own indigenous melancholy, and I am healthy enough these days to be able to feel the difference between me and it. This is a sign I cannot help but think of healing, of the coagulation of myself. There were a few years there lost in borderless despair, when I used to experience all the world's sadness as my own. Everything sad leaked through me and left damp traces behind. Anyhow, it's hard to be depressed with Linda babbling beside me, trying to get me to buy a giant purple fur hat and asking of the lousy dinner we ate one night, "Are these called Mrs. Paul's veal sticks?" She is a firefly, this Linda. In Venice, in the Middle Ages, there was once a profession for a man called a codega, a fellow you hired to walk in front of you at night with a lit lantern, showing you the way, scaring off thieves and demons, bringing you confidence and protection through the dark streets. This is Linda, my temporary, special order, travel-sized Venetian codega. 33. I step off the train a few days later to a Rome full of hot, sunny, eternal disorder. Immediately upon walking out into the street, I can hear the soccer stadium-like cheers of a nearby manifestazione, another labor demonstration. What they are striking about this time, my taxi driver cannot tell me, mainly because, it seems, he doesn't care. "Sti cazzi," he says about the strikers. Literal translation, "these balls," or, as we might say, "I don't give a shit." It's nice to be back. After the staid sobriety of Venice, it's nice to be back where I can see a man in a leopard skin jacket walking past a pair of teenagers making out right in the middle of the street. The city is so awake and alive, so dolled up and sexy in the sunshine. I remember something that my friend Maria's husband Giulio said to me once. We were sitting in an outdoor cafe, having our conversation practice, and he asked me what I thought of Rome. I told him that I loved the place, of course, but somehow knew it was not my city, not where I'd end up living for the rest of my life. There was something about Rome that didn't belong to me, and I couldn't quite figure out what it was. Just as we were talking, a helpful visual aid walked by. It was the quintessential Roman woman, a fantastically maintained, jewelry-sodden, 40-something-year-old dame wearing 4-inch heels, a tight skirt with a slit as long as your arm, and those sunglasses that look like race cars and probably cost as much. She was walking her little fancy dog on a gem-studded leash, and the fur collar on her tight jacket looked as if it had been made out of the pelt of her former little fancy dog. She was exuding an unbelievably glamorous air of, "You will look at me, but I will refuse to look at you." It was hard to imagine that she had ever, even for 10 minutes in her life, not worn mascara. This woman was in every way the opposite of me, who dresses in a style my sister refers to as Stevie Nicks goes to yoga class in her pajamas. I pointed that woman out to Giulio, and I said, "See, Giulio, that is a Roman woman. Rome cannot be her city and my city, too. Only one of us really belongs here, and I think we both know which one." Giulio said, "Maybe you and Rome just have different words." "What do you mean?" He said, "Don't you know that the secret to understanding a city and its people is to learn what is the word of the street?" Then he went on to explain, in a mixture of English, Italian, and hand gestures, that every city has a single word that defines it and identifies most of the people who live there. If you could read people's thoughts as they were passing you on the streets of any given place, you would discover that most of them are thinking the same thought. Whatever that majority thought might be, that is the word of the city. And if your personal word does not match the word of the city, then you don't really belong there. "What's Rome's word?" I asked. "Sex," he announced. "But isn't that a stereotype about Rome?" "No. But surely there are some people in Rome thinking about other things than sex?" Giulio insisted. "No. All of them, all day, all they are thinking about is sex." "Even over at the Vatican?" "That's different. The Vatican isn't part of Rome. They have a different word over there. Their word is power." "You'd think it'd be faith." "It's power," he repeated. "Trust me. But the word in Rome? It's sex." Now, if you are to believe Giulio, that little word, sex, cobbles the streets beneath your feet in Rome, runs through the fountains here, fills the air like traffic noise. Thinking about it, dressing for it, seeking it, considering it, refusing it, making a sport and a game out of it, that's all anybody is doing. Which would make a bit of sense as to why, for all its gorgeousness, Rome doesn't quite feel like my hometown. Not at this moment in my life. Because sex isn't my word right now. It has been at other times in my life, but it isn't right now. Therefore, Rome's word, as it spins through the streets, just bumps up against me and tumbles off, leaving no impact. I'm not participating in the word, so I'm not fully living here. It's a kooky theory, impossible to prove, but I kind of like it. Giulio asked, "What's the word in New York City?" I thought about this for a moment, then decided, "It's a verb, of course. I think it's achieve." Which is subtly but significantly different than the word in Los Angeles, I believe, which is also a verb, succeed. Later I will share this whole theory with my Swedish friend Sophie, and she will offer her opinion that the word on the streets of Stockholm is conform, which depresses both of us. I asked Giulio, "What's the word in Naples?" He knows the south of Italy well. "Fight," he decides. "What was the word in your family when you were growing up?" That one was difficult. I was trying to think of a single word that somehow combines both frugal and irreverent. But Giulio was already on to the next and most obvious question. "What's your word?" Now that I definitely could not answer. And still, after a few weeks of thinking about it, I can't answer it any better now. I know some words that it definitely isn't. It's not marriage, that's evident. It's not family, though this was the word of the town I'd lived in for a few years with my husband, and since I did not fit with that word, this was a big cause of my suffering. It's not depression anymore, thank heavens. I'm not concerned that I share Stockholm's word of conform, but I don't feel that I'm entirely inhabiting New York City's achieve anymore either, though that had indeed been my word all throughout my 20s. My word might